question concerning Amanda. Where to begin looking for her? Painter voiced the same question. Were you able to get any clue from inside the cabin? Anything that might point to where they were taking Amanda? Gray stared at the smoking pile of debris. We didn't have any time. She could be anywhere. Painter let out a long sigh, not in defeat, but in renewed determination. Then we start from scratch. We're not giving up. I'll see what I can do at my end. You and Captain Alden canvass any locals in the area. Someone must know something. In the rush to evacuate, something might have fallen through the cracks. Gray agreed. The enemy clearly hadn't expected his team to arrive at the camp so quickly, if at all. Pierce! The call came from Tucker. He turned and found the man waving to him from the road that exited the camp. Tucker stepped aside to allow a small figure to run into view. It was Bashi. Gray had last seen the boy diving into the forest after almost getting shot. Seishan had gone out to look for him. She appeared steps behind him, dragging a prisoner with her, clutching him by the shirt collar as he stumbled alongside her. Gray spoke into the phone. Director, I'll call you back in a few minutes. We may have caught a break. Signing off, he strode over to the group. Captain Alden headed over there, too. Seishan met Gray's eyes as he reached her. I found Bashi leading this kid back out of the forest, heading our way. Bashi vigorously nodded. I tell him you all good. Tucker looked pale. It's the same boy I jumped earlier by the creek. Gray saw he was right. It was the child Tucker had strangled and hogtied. So the bound boy had been discovered by the enemy. No wonder the crew had hightailed it back to camp. Kid must have fled during our attack on the third truck, Seishan said. But Bashi tracked him in the woods and convinced him we were okay. From his wide, scared eyes, the new boy must be wondering if he'd made the right decision. Mr. Trevor! Bashi burst out brightly and ran to meet the British captain as he joined them. He patted Alden on the chest and spoke to the other boy. This the man I tell you about. Seeing the confused look on the captive's face, Bashi repeated what he said in Somali. Then he stepped over like an excited tour guide and patted Kane, too, ending with, he good dog. Gray sidled next to Alden during all of this. See if Bashi could ask the boy if he knows where Amanda was taken. I'll do my best. Gray had to wait while a fervid series of exchanges commenced. It involved a lot of back and forth and not a few suspicious glances cast his way. Finally, the boy seemed to relent. Pointing this way and that, he spoke briskly in Somali. Alden eventually straightened and rejoined Gray. It seems like with Bashi, people are willing to speak more openly around a child. He overheard some of the medical staff at the camp talking, making preparations to move the young woman to an airfield used by drug runners. He says he heard them speak of flying to Dubai, but I don't know if that's just a stopover or a final destination, because he also said they're planning to go to heaven. To go to heaven? What did that mean? Was it some sort of suicide pact? That didn't sound like the enemy, and certainly not the guild. Alden must have read his confusion and shrugged. He had no better explanation. Still, Gray's mood lightened. At least Dubai gives us a solid place to start looking, to hopefully pick up her trail again. Alden stared over at Jine on a stretcher, one pant leg cut away. Good luck, Commander. I'll see to the boys here. He motioned to Bashi and the other kid. In the meantime, the thumping of a helicopter cut him off, drawing his attention skyward. I believe that's your SEAL team, the captain said. A bit late to the bloody party, but they can help secure the area. I'd suggest you and your team borrow that helo of mine. Clear out before too many questions get asked. Before that, Gray started. About Amanda. Alden winked at him. I heard she died here. A real tragedy. So the good captain had already perceived, as Painter had, that Amanda's best chance of survival lay in everyone continuing to believe that lie. That's what I'll be reporting to my superiors. Thank you, Gray said, and shook the man's hand, grasping his forearm with the other. No thanks needed, mate. If it wasn't for your quick thinking, there would have been more casualties at that UNICEF camp, including possibly my own men. With matters settled, Gray drew his group together and hurried toward the idling chopper. He wanted to be out of here before the SEALs clamped things down. The SEAL team was under orders to retrieve the charred body, to return the supposed remains of the president's daughter back to the States, not a duty he would wish on anyone. He called Painter again, reported what he'd learned, and coordinated logistics on their next move. We're pulling up stakes here, Gray said. Any intelligence Cat can gather while we're en route would help us hit the ground running once we're wheels down in Dubai City. Understood. I'll put a team on it. But I've got Cat working another angle. Gray paused as everyone loaded into the helicopter. Tucker lifted his dog. What other angle? As Painter explained his worry that all of this bloodshed and terror somehow involved Amanda's unborn child, Gray pictured the brutality of the cesarean performed on the anonymous woman, her body charred beyond recognition. In his gut, Gray knew the director was correct. This was all about the baby. As he signed off and strapped into his seat aboard the chopper, another concern nagged him. It also centered on Amanda and her child. Gray couldn't escape the sense that Painter had been withholding something from him. The director's decision to keep Amanda's survival a secret from her own parents never sat right with him. Painter was certainly a master chess player and could be cold-hearted and tough when he had his back against the wall. But never this callous. His explanation felt forced, like there was something he didn't want to share about Amanda or her family. But what could it be? With a roar of its engines, the helicopter slowly rose from the ruins of the camp, stirring smoke and ash, leaving the horrors below. He might not know what gambit Painter was playing, but he knew one thing for certain. This was just the beginning. Much worse was still to come. 11 p.m., Eastern Standard Time, Washington, D.C. Robert Gant stepped through the airlock and entered the Class 1000 clean room, a stark white chamber with glass walls that looked out into the rest of the genomics lab. Staffed only by three researchers, the entire facility lay in an industrial area on the outskirts of Alexandria, Virginia, and was listed as a private DNA test lab. But that was not its purpose. Its true function had been etched into one of the glass walls of the clean room, a frosted cross, decorated with spirals of DNA along its cross pieces. "Show me," he said, using the deep baritone that served him well in the past as a U.S. ambassador and now as Secretary of State. He allowed some of his irritation to ring out. He'd left Jimmy and Teresa to their grief to attend to private family business, but he wanted to keep this visit as short as possible. The researcher, Dr. Emmett Fielding, decked out in white coveralls, gloves, boots, and hood, drew him to a laboratory table. A sealed crystal cylinder, about the size and shape of a hockey puck, held a murky aquamarine fluid. Beside it on the table rested a titanium sculpture that looked like a clawless crab supported by six articulated legs. Its flat metal carapace measured a foot across, reminding Robert of the landmines that still peppered Southeast Asia, where he'd spent the bulk of his ambassadorship. Fielding lifted the cylinder from the table and held it in the palm of his hand. "This is the latest generation," he said proudly. 500,000 neurons harvested from human fetal cortical tissue to form this new brain. And once implanted, It will communicate via 5,000 microelectrodes, a fourfold improvement from the last generation, and a huge advance from where this all started. This was Robert's pet project. He had learned of the first tentative steps taken by the University of Reading in England back in 2009. A researcher in neurorobotics discovered that a handful of neurons, collected from the cortex of lab rats and grown in a culture medium, could be wired into a small wheeled robot. And through electrode stimulation, it could control and operate the tiny vehicle, learning over time as new synapses formed to avoid objects and work through mazes. Shortly thereafter, another scientist at the University of Florida upped the ante, wiring 25,000 rat neurons to a flight simulator. Over time, that tiny brain learned to fly a jet flawlessly through mountains and thunderstorms. Years later, utilizing the family's financial and technological resources, Robert had moved that bar much higher. Initially, the research had been folded into a larger project, one going back decades, investigating the fusion of man and machine as a means of extending life, a goal sought by the bloodline for centuries. But this research into cyborg technology proved to be a dead end. It became clear that it would never be a feasible means to sustaining or prolonging life, especially with the more promising advent of stem cell research. At that point in time, the bloodline turned its eye in a new direction, forsaking the macro world of robotics for the micro world of genetics. But even Robert didn't have full access to that newest venture. Instead, he'd been left to oversee this older project. Neurorobotics still showed the potential to be a lucrative new weapons technology for the military. If rat brains could fly jet planes years ago, why not something more ambitious for the battlefield of the future? "Let me give you a demonstration of the hexapod," Fielding said. The researcher opened the titanium carapace of the metal crab, exposing the microelectronics inside. He seated the neural cylinder into the electrode base at the heart of the pod and secured everything in place. Next, he carried the device to a neighboring chamber in the clean room. It had been set up as a test maze, but this was no ordinary flat puzzle. This labyrinth filled the entire 10x10 chamber, rising through 15 levels of tunnels, chutes, and spirals. "I ran the hexapod through this maze once already today. Now watch." Fielding inserted the crab-like machine through a lower slot, sealed the door, and used a Bluetooth device to activate it. Tiny green lights flared along a groove that ran around the periphery of the hexapod's carapace. Titanium legs stretched and tapped. Robert leaned closer, unimpressed. "Why isn't it?" The creature shot away, dancing on its six legs, gaining speed until it was a silvery blur. It sped through the maze with unerring accuracy, no doubling back to correct a wrong turn. It had remembered the complex path through the maze perfectly. "I'm estimating the new brain's neural intelligence is about that of your average canine," Fielding said proudly. A half minute later, the hexapod reached the exit platform near the top, skidding to a stop. Robert grinned. "Impressive." Fielding matched that expression, thrilled at the rare praise. He reached to the door and unlatched it. But before he could swing it open, the hexapod rammed forward. It burst out and latched its legs onto the researcher's forearm. The sharp-pointed legs dug into his flesh. Blood seeped through his white coveralls. Fielding yelled and hit the Bluetooth controller, powering down the hexapod. Still, he had to return to the table and manually pry each leg out of his arm to get it to release. "The aggression of this newest generation is also through the roof," Fielding said, wincing and nursing his bloody arm as proof. "I'd say we've engineered the equivalent of a limbic region of the mammalian brain. The lizard intelligence buried beneath the cortex, driven by base needs for survival." For a battlefield weapon, that's not an undesirable trait. True. And speaking of battlefield, you promised a field trial of the latest hexapods. That's why I came all the way down here in person. Of course. I have a monitor set up over here with live feed from the lodge. Everything's ready. They've been waiting for the green light. Robert followed Fielding to a 52-inch HD monitor. The screen was subdivided into sections, each offering a different bird's-eye view of a remote and isolated patch of woodland hills hundreds of miles away. The centermost square showed a small concrete bunker sticking out of a meadow, like a giant anthill. A metal door sealed it shut. "If you're ready," Fielding said. "Get on with it," Robert snapped. Fielding spoke into a cell phone. Moments later, the metal door burst open, and a woman was shoved outside. She wore a hospital gown and nothing else. She stumbled to her knees, shielding her eyes against the midday sun. Robert absently wondered how long it had been since the young woman had seen actual sunlight. From the way she jumped and glanced back to the door, someone must have barked at her. They're telling her to run if she wants to live. Robert frowned, not appreciating the sadism. This was an experiment, not a bloody sport, and should be conducted as such. The subject took off for the forest at a dead run. There! Fielding pointed to movement through the grasses, a dozen arrows aiming for the fleeing woman. A pair split off, zipping away faster, intending to flank her. Look how they're pattern swarming. I employed a new wireless communication system and linked the individual hexapods to one another, allowing them to function as a group or a pack. Look how quickly they're learning. Robert watched, half aghast, half excited. The woman made it to the edge of the woods, but she must have heard the hunters. She looked over a shoulder, and the horror of what she saw tripped her feet. She fell to her knees, her mouth open in a silent scream. Then the hunters reached her. It didn't take long. Fielding held his chin in one hand, appraising the trial. The new battlefield modifications of the pods seemed to be working as engineered. The circular blades, the razored leg flanges, all performed flawlessly. I may want to tinker with the digging spades, see if I can get them to burrow better. I've seen enough, Robert said, straightening and stepping away. Fielding followed him. With your approval, I'd like to move the testing forward into the larger quadrupod line. That would be fine. Fielding pressed him. But I'd need a few more test subjects. Something more challenging. Robert pictured the macerated remains of the woman on the screen. I'm sure we can find them somewhere. Second, Heaven and Hell. Chapter 18. July 2nd, 11:56 a.m., Eastern Standard Time. Charleston, South Carolina. Captain Catherine Bryant had come to sell her body. She stepped off the crosstown bus into the steamy swelter of a Charleston summer. Her worn sneakers crunched in the gravel at the shoulder of the road. She pulled on a pair of cheap sunglasses purchased at the airport against the glare of the sun, but they did nothing for the heat. 90 degrees with 90% humidity. I thought Washington's summers were bad. In a feeble attempt to compensate, she'd braided her long auburn hair into a ponytail and wore a ball cap to shade her face. She also wore a pair of light shorts and a nondescript loose blouse, no bra, finishing her appearance as a down-on-her-luck woman looking for a little extra money. The bus pulled away with a choking cough of diesel fumes. She followed in its wake. The North Charleston Fertility Clinic rose two blocks ahead. The complex covered a full city block, set amid a small park of towering oaks and palmettos. The rest of the neighborhood was a mix of commercial businesses and trailer parks. She wasn't unfamiliar with the area, having spent a few months while in service at the Naval Weapons Station, which hugged the Cooper River 3 miles away. As she headed toward the clinic, she slipped out her cell phone to keep a promise. The phone was a disposable, tied to her alias. She connected her call through Sigma to ensure it couldn't be traced. If anyone tried to pull the LUDs, the phone records would only discover a call placed to a local pawn shop. The line clicked, and a gruff voice answered.
"So you're still alive?"
Her husband, Monk, did his best to make it sound like a joke, but she heard the undercurrent of tension in his voice. He hadn't been thrilled she'd taken this assignment, but he understood the necessity. "For the moment," she replied with a smile. "I'm just heading toward the clinic."
"You give them hell."
Her smile widened. "That's the plan." She pictured Monk at their apartment, balancing one of their babies on his knee. He wasn't what most women would consider handsome, with his shaved head and stocky but muscular physique, but he still could make her melt with his smile, and she'd never met a man with a bigger heart, a heart that only grew larger with each addition to the household. "Did you give Harriet her second bottle?" she asked. An exasperated sigh followed.
"Yes, dear. And I went to Costco and got the Pampers. You go save the world. I've got things covered here."
She had hoped her call would erase that edge of apprehension hiding behind his jovial banter, but it only seemed to make it worse. "Monk, I'm almost at the clinic. Give Penny and Harriet a kiss for me."
"Done. And I'll save what I've got for you until you get home."
"Ah, always my gallant knight," she said sarcastically. But it was forced, because he was her knight, and always would be. His voice grew husky.
"Just get back here safely."
"I promise."
"You'd better. I'm holding you to it."
After she hung up, the world seemed slightly less bright. A twinge of guilt plagued her as she pocketed her phone. "What am I doing here? I should be at home." Still, she couldn't discount the electric thrill that coursed through her as she reached the clinic grounds and turned her attention to the task at hand. It happened with every mission. She had a duty, and she was good at what she did. And knowing her family was safe, and always would be with Monk, helped steady her. He was a rock, even hundreds of miles away. With renewed determination, she crossed along the tall, stacked stone fence of the clinic and stepped through the wrought iron gates, entering a garden oasis set amidst the surrounding commercial parks. A path led alongside the entry road, winding through manicured hedgerows, small burbling fountains, and perfumed beds of blush pink roses. Someone had gone to great expense to make the clinic feel warm and inviting, a veritable Garden of Eden, where dreams of infertile couples couldn't help but come true. No wonder this place drew celebrity clients and people from around the globe, including the president's daughter. Then again, the complex was owned by a subsidiary of a Gant family enterprise, one dedicated to biotech and genetic engineering. The clinic, established in the early 80s, was the end result of much of that research, offering the latest innovations to the public. The clinic also employed its own research protocols, drawing reproductive scientists from as far away as Japan. The place continued to be at the forefront of fertility studies and stem cell research. Over the past 18 hours, Kat had investigated the clinic extensively, from its staffing and clientele down to its latest tax filings. She knew everything about the clinic, where they got their bed linens, the average weight of their hazardous waste material. The deeper she delved, the more certain she grew that the root of Amanda's kidnapping lay hidden somewhere within the four buildings that made up this facility. This conviction came not from anything she uncovered, but from what she didn't. After a full decade gathering global intelligence, she had developed a nose for when something was being hidden from her. During her investigation, she had reached too many dead ends that made no sense. Certain matters that didn't balance in her head. Worst of all, she stumbled across an impenetrable corporate firewall at one point, employing encryption algorithms that were military grade. Even if she could, she feared smashing through it. The act alone could set off too many alarm bells, alerting the powers that be at the clinic that someone was sniffing at their door. So she opted for a more direct approach. On foot. She reached the parking lot and spotted the rental car, a silver Audi A6 sedan. Lisa Cummings had beaten her here, but her friend hadn't had to navigate through two bus transfers from the airport to reach the clinic. They had come separately, each with her own mission. Kat climbed the steps to a wide porch that fronted the main building. It looked nothing like a medical facility. The facade was typical for Charleston, a Georgian stone mansion with wrought iron railings, three floors of balconies, and a gambrel roof covered by mossy-fringed slate tiles. She stepped through the doors into an air-conditioned main lobby, refreshing after the hot bus ride and short walk. A reception desk beckoned. She approached it, noting out of the corner of her eye that Lisa sat in the waiting area, a space as sumptuously furnished as would be expected from the exterior, decked out in velvets and overstuffed cushions. Lisa matched the decor in a handsome St. John platinum dress with a drawstring waist. Her blonde hair hung loose and shone under the soft lights, her makeup flawless. She came posing as the private doctor for a select Washingtonian clientele, coming to interview the clinic for possible referrals for her patients. She had an appointment to meet with the head of the facility in a few minutes. Lisa was conducting this cursory investigation from the top down. Kat was taking the other extreme. "How may I help you?" the receptionist asked. She was a small woman with large eyes, made even more prominent by her harsh eyeshadow. Kat moved closer to the desk, pressing against it, leaning a bit too forward as if trying to keep the conversation from being overheard. "I heard, someone told me, that you all are looking for donors." The receptionist's brows pinched in irritation. Kat pushed even closer, glancing surreptitiously over her shoulder, raising an embarrassed blush to her cheek. "You know, looking for a woman's eggs. I heard you pay good money." The receptionist sat straighter, her voice growing hushed, if not a touch condescending, made worse by the patronizing tone of her Carolina accent. "Hun, that's handled elsewhere. This is for patient intake. If you'll stand over there." She waved a manicured hand away from the waiting area toward a corner. "I'll have one of the staff assistants come fetch you and bring you to the donor facility, if that's all right." Kat nodded and slunk back. "Thank you." The woman made a non-committal noise and picked up the phone. As Kat retreated to her corner, she met Lisa's gaze. At the moment, they were divided by a cultural and financial gulf. Lisa represented the end buyer. Kat embodied the product to be sold. There continued to be much ethical and moral debate about the sale of human ova. Once a price tag was put upon such a commodity, it became tied to the power of supply and demand, and the inherent abuse. In much of the Third World, entire villages now sold kidneys or became surrogate mothers, selling rental space in their wombs. It was called the Red Market, the wholesale buying and selling of body parts, and it was a booming business, both legally and illegally. She had read a report of Bolivian murderers who sought out victims to sell their fat to European beauty supply companies. In China, prisons were harvesting the organs of dead inmates, gutting them out, with whispers that some prisoners were being purposefully killed for profit. And in one case in Nepal, a dairy farmer had turned from delivering milk to supplying blood. He captured local hikers, imprisoned them in his barn, and repeatedly drained his new livestock of their blood, keeping them forever at the edge of death. Worst of all, such a marketplace moved in only one economic direction, from the poor to the rich. It was an unfortunate side effect when a price tag was placed on organs. Inevitably, flesh moved only up the social ladder, never down. Movement across the room drew Kat's attention. A mahogany door opened, and a rugged-looking man in his mid-40s stepped into the waiting room. He had jet-black hair, stood 6 feet tall, and was decked out in a knee-length white lab coat over expensive navy blue trousers, a crisp white shirt, and a crimson tie. His smile was overly broad as he approached Lisa, who stood to greet him. "Welcome to NCFC," he said, and shook her hand. It was Dr. Paul Cranston, head of the clinic. Kat knew everything about him, even his social security number and where his passport had last been stamped, New Zealand. He led Lisa out of the waiting room and into the inner sanctum of the facility. As that door closed, another opened. A man, likely a hospital orderly, stood at the threshold of a doorway neighboring the front desk. He looked like a pit bull in scrubs. The receptionist beckoned to Kat. She stepped forward. "If you'll follow me," the man grunted, not bothering with her name. She hurried forward, but stopped at the reception desk to grab a business card. She fumbled and purposefully knocked the holder off the counter and onto the reception desk. "I'm so sorry," she said, reaching over to help collect the scattered cards. The receptionist sighed heavily and picked a few cards off the floor by her chair. Kat used the moment to slip the ballpoint pen palmed in her hand into the receptionist's cup. It held a tiny camera that recorded audio and video passively to a micro SD chip. A small antenna allowed burst transmissions of the saved data with the pinged call from a cell phone. She had four more pens in her purse, with the goal of strategically placing them in key locations throughout the facility, or at least where she could reach without raising an alarm. If given the chance, it would be easy for a confused girl to get lost in here and wander where she didn't belong. But first, she had a role to play. "Just go," the receptionist said, and pointed to the side door. Kat apologized meekly and followed the orderly waiting for her. He led her out of the world of gardens and velvets and into a sterile environment of vinyl floors and stark white walls. Here was the hospital hidden behind the facade, sparse and utilitarian. They eventually reached and entered a short enclosed walkway that connected the main building to a more drab structure at the back of the grounds. As she marched, she noted each of the four clinic wings were connected in a similar manner. It seemed there was no need to leave the air-conditioned splendor for the summer heat. She also eyed the windowed walls to either side. The glass was thick, appearing bulletproof. Then again, the clinic's clientele were often celebrities or foreign dignitaries. Maybe the extra protection was necessary. Still, a chill that had nothing to do with the air conditioning swept through her. The space felt less protective than it was imprisoning. They entered the next building, and Kat was taken to a small examination room, one of a long row of them in this wing. The orderly handed her a series of forms to fill out, secured on a clipboard. "Fill everything out. Someone will be in to talk to you in a few minutes." He left, looking as bored as when he'd first collected her. She began to fill out the forms when she heard a small click at the door. Stepping forward, she tested the handle. Locked. She frowned, fighting back a flicker of panic. Securing the door might be protocol to maintain confidentiality. Either way, she was committed. She'd have to keep playing her hand. But something was definitely wrong about this place. She hoped Lisa was faring better. 12:18 p.m. As you can see, we do all of our work in-house, Dr. Paul Cranston said, stopping before a window that looked into a sealed in vitro fertilization lab. Lisa studied the space with a critical eye. The room was state-of-the-art, with enclosed workstations equipped with laser oocyte scanners and Narashige micromanipulators for egg fertilization. Nothing was substandard, from Mockler counting chambers to automatic sperm analyzers, advanced warming blocks, and cryogenic chambers. Her guided tour had already included the surgical suite, used for both egg collection and embryo implantation. The clinic's high-tech operating theater would put most hospitals to shame. Even the neighboring recovery rooms were private spaces that could have graced the pages of Architectural Digest, with fine linens, subdued lighting, and tasteful decorations. Clearly, this tour was meant to impress. And it did. "We are a one-stop shop," Cranston finished, offering a beaming, self-effacing smile. "From sperm and egg collection to fertilization and implantation, we do all of our own patient monitoring, but we're certainly happy to work in collaboration with a primary care physician." Lisa nodded. "I'm sure some of my clients would prefer the anonymity of care outside the DC circles."
"Understood."
His eyes lingered a bit too long on her. Plainly, he desired to know more about whom she represented, but he knew better than to inquire directly. Lisa's ironclad cover had been built to draw the personal interest of the clinic's head, and obviously succeeded. She had been given the grand tour, along with the full-court sales press. "Why don't we return to my office? I can supply you with brochures detailing each level of service, including fact sheets containing our success rates, and of course, I'll be happy to answer any other questions."
"That would be perfect."
She checked her watch in a move to urge him to hurry along. "I won't take up much more of your time." His office was up a level from the workspaces. It was like walking into a mahogany library, with bookshelf-lined walls, trophies, and framed diplomas, including one from Harvard, his alma mater. Like the rest of the tour, the room was also designed to impress. Huge arched windows overlooked the park-like grounds with views to the other three buildings that made up the complex. Cranston circled around his desk, where a prepared binder was already waiting for her atop his leather desk blotter. He handed it toward her, but she ignored it, focusing her attention out the window. She also kept a keen eye on his reactions. Besides a medical degree, she had earned a master's in physiology. She understood bodily responses and could read them as accurately as most lie detectors. But unlike those detectors, she also knew how to manipulate those responses for a desired result. Now to get to work. "What happens in those other buildings?" she asked. He lowered the binder and followed her gaze outside. "The wing directly behind this one is for donor evaluation and collection." Lisa eyed the three-story structure. "That must be where Cat is." "The other two buildings are strictly for research," he said. "We run reproductive studies for a dozen different universities, including as far away as the University of Tokyo and Oxford." She turned her back to the window. "I'm assuming that any biological specimens, eggs, or embryos for my patients wouldn't be used for such purposes without their consent."
"Of course not.
We have a robust donor program that supplies such material. Let me assure you, Dr. Cummings, our research programs and patient services are completely separate. There is no crossover."
"Very good."
Lisa returned to the chair in front of his wide desk and sank into the seat, shifting her purse into her lap. "Now, let me be frank with you, Dr. Cranston."
"Please, call me Paul."
She smiled, giving him that much. "Paul, I must be honest that I've been considering other facilities. It's come down to here or a clinic outside of Philadelphia."
"Of course."
He kept an even demeanor, but she didn't mistake the flicker of desire. To poach another client was even better than merely to win one. That was the bait. But I assure you, he continued, you'll find no other facility with the level of technological advancement, the latest tools, and the professional staff to oversee each stage of the process. Cranston definitely wanted her imaginary high-profile client list. But how badly? First, to let some slack in the line, intended to unnerve him. I understand and appreciate that, Paul, but Philadelphia is also much closer to D.C. I must take that convenience into account. My client's time is very important. He looked crestfallen. I can't argue with that. Now to dangle hope. But your clinic has one distinct advantage. Beyond your stellar medical reputation, you have an unmatched social reputation, an excellent pedigree, if you will. How so? Amanda Gant Bennett. The edges of his eyelids grew more strained at the mention of Amanda. Several of my patients are well acquainted with the First Family, she continued. They know of the delicate situation regarding the president's daughter and how matters were handled at your clinic. In many ways, Washington is a small town. She offered him a modest smile. He echoed it, the desired effect. One patient of mine in particular is faced with a similar situation, an infertile husband. She asked me to specifically inquire into your donor program. To put it bluntly, using my patient's words, if it's good enough for the president's daughter, it's good enough for me. She rolled her eyes, feigning amused disdain. In certain Washington circles, whether it's the latest purse or the season's designer fashions, name brands are all that matter. And this even extends to the choice of medical facility, and in this case, even the preference of donor. He gave her an understanding nod and steepled his fingers under his chin. There is, of course, no way to divulge who was the male donor in this situation, but I can guarantee you that each of our donors must pass the most thorough and exacting background check and evaluation. Each is ranked on several criteria: physical appearance, IQ, medical history, ethnic background, and many others. And if someone wanted to pick a donor of, let us say, equal criteria as the president's daughter? His smile grew steadier as he discovered a way to win her over. It was human nature. To almost have something in one's grasp, then suddenly lose it, only made the desire to win it back that much stronger. It was why gambling was so addictive. I'm sure that could be arranged, he said. We'd hate to lose you. I'm sure you would. Wonderful. She rewarded him with a genuine smile of delight. And would it be possible to obtain a list and description of such donors? Something tangible I can present to my client? As they say, the proof is in the pudding. Cranston swung to his computer. Certainly. If you can give me a few minutes. She settled back into her chair. Painter wanted that shortened list of donors, a way to narrow down the number of potential biological fathers for Amanda's unborn child. But he also needed a way to turn the anonymity of those donors into real names. That meant gaining access to clinic records. As Cranston worked, Lisa snapped open her purse and pretended to check her phone. She pressed a button on it as instructed by Painter, then slipped the thin device into the seat cushions of her chair, using her purse to hide her actions. The phone had a wireless micro-router built into it, allowing Sigma to link and hack into the clinic's server. Painter had tried to explain it in more detail, but electronic engineering was not her specialty. All she knew was to follow his instructions, wait until Cranston had logged into the computer and used his password, then activate the wireless router and leave it running nearby. She clicked her purse closed. Her work here was done. It seemed too easy, but then again, it was supposed to be. Painter had described the mission here as a soft infiltration. Rather than a full frontal storming of the gates, Kat and Lisa's only goal was to leave a trail of electronic breadcrumbs, listening devices, cameras, wireless taps.
Most of the tools had been engineered by Painter, made for easy concealment and minimal signature.
But anything can be detected given enough time, Painter had warned.
So the second part of this mission was not to loiter, and she obeyed that now. In short order, she had everything she needed from Dr. Cranston, including the binder of brochures and information. He walked her back to the lobby, left her with promises to keep in touch, and she soon found herself back under the swelter of the midday sun. She headed over and climbed into her Audi sedan, a luxurious rental to match her cover. Though her part of the mission was complete, a knot of tension remained in her neck. The plan was for Kat to meet her back at their hotel in downtown Charleston. She would be relieved only when they were rejoined. From there, the electronic devices could do all the spying for them. She swung her sedan out of the parking lot and onto the street, still worried about Kat, feeling guilty for abandoning her partner. Her only reassurance, Kat was a pro. Nothing fazed her. 1:14 p.m. What the hell is going on here? Pacing the small exam room, Kat checked the clock on her disposable phone. It had been over an hour since she first walked through the clinic's front door. She should have been in and out by now. She had completed the sheaf of paperwork and handed it to the same orderly who marched her here and locked her in the room. He'd told her to sit tight, that the initial approval process could take some time, and that it wasn't all paperwork. A doctor will be in to do a pelvic exam and ultrasound in a few minutes. You will be paid a small stipend now in order to draw your blood and collect a urine sample. Within 5 business days, you will be informed by phone whether you are selected as a donor. This was all related in a bored monotone, as if he'd repeated the same speech 100 times each day. And maybe he did. Through the walls, she heard other men and women coming and going, doors opening and closing along the long exam hallway. She had hoped to get a cursory tour of the donation center, to plan another pen camera here, maybe even attempt to reach the other 2 research buildings. That didn't seem likely unless she was bolder. She stepped to the secured door. She had a lockpick incorporated into the sole of her right shoe and a folded combat blade hidden in her left. But her escape out of a locked room would be hard to explain if she was caught later. There was an easier way. She knocked loudly and raised a plaintive lilt to her call. "Hello? I need to use the bathroom. Can someone help me, please?" It didn't take long for the door to be unlocked. She expected to see the same orderly as before, but instead it was a white-smocked doctor, a svelte woman with gray eyes. The orderly hovered behind her, holding a tray with a rack of vacuum tubes for blood collection and an array of syringes. The only warning of trouble, one of the syringes was full. Before she could react, the doctor stepped forward and jammed a black wand against her stomach. The snap of electricity was loud in the small space. Agony shot through her body, centered on her belly, contracting her abdominal muscles. Her limbs betrayed her, and she toppled to the side, a slim edge away from a full convulsion. Anticipating this, the doctor caught her and lowered her to the floor. The orderly closed the door and came around her other side, syringe in hand. Even through the electric pain, she felt the needle jab in her neck. Her vision began to immediately close down. Kat fought against it, wondering how her cover could have been blown. She'd been so thorough to craft her alias as a shiftless transient with no familial or local ties, nothing that could be easily verified or tracked back to her. Unfortunately, that proved her undoing. "She seems in better than average shape," the doctor said to the orderly, examining Kat as if she were a prized pig at a county fair. "Unusual. Feel that muscle tone. I don't see any track marks on her arm or signs of chronic drug use. You're sure she met the standard protocol?" "Everything checked out, Dr. Marshall. She just moved here. No job, no family. Changed cities 3 times in the past year before coming here. Gainesville, Atlanta, now Charleston. No one to miss her. Kat's world folded and closed over her. Their conversation followed her into oblivion. Then it's perfect timing. I received a message from the lodge a short time ago. They're demanding more research subjects. Kat felt her body lifted by the muscular orderly. The lodge? He asked. Do you know what they do up there? Trust me, you don't want to know.
Chapter 19. July 2nd, 10:20 p.m., Gulf Standard Time. Dubai City, United Arab Emirates. Gray stood before the hotel windows and stared out at the jeweled nightscape of Dubai's skyline, an emerald oasis perched between the desert and the blue sea. Towers and cloud-scraping spires blazed with lights, rising from a modern mecca of huge malls, hotels, and trendy residential complexes, all wired and connected by ribbons of flowing neon of every fathomable hue. The panorama looked less like a city and more like a glowing circuit board buzzing with the electricity of the entire region. It seemed impossible that 5 hours ago he'd been in a country devastated by war, famine, and drought, a land ruled as much by pirates as any government. Now he floated above a miracle. Grown at a blistering pace, Dubai had risen like a mirage out of the desert, with the crown jewel being Burj Khalifa, over 200 stories high, the tallest skyscraper in the world, appearing like a thin mountain pinnacle at the edge of the sea. Architects from around the world continued to compete to construct the most awe-inspiring designs, seemingly with one common theme, the defiance of nature and its elements. Within the city, one could lounge on a sun-baked beach and an hour later be snowboarding down the slopes of the world's largest indoor ski resort. And if one wanted the best of both worlds, the newly opened Palazzo Versace Hotel had its own refrigerated beach to keep tourists cool while sunbathing. But the greatest of the nature-defying projects lay beyond the beaches, Dubai's famous man-made islands. Their hotel neighbored Palm Jumeirah, an artificial archipelago in the shape of a palm tree, so large it could be seen from space. Its trunk grew out from the mainland and burst forth with 16 fronds, all circled by a crescent-shaped breakwater. Another 2 such islands were being constructed along the coastline, multiplying the amount of Dubai beachfront tenfold. Gray had read of other projects still in the works for Dubai, a 27-acre underwater hotel called Hydropolis, a German-designed floating palace made entirely of ice, fancifully named the Blue Crystal, and even farther out to sea, the partially completed deep-sea island of Utopia, shaped like a starfish and sheltered by a breakwater crescent intended both as a tourist destination and a corporate enclave due to its unique isolation. Here in Dubai, nature held no sway against the lofty dreams of man.
"You gotta try the shower, Pierce." Kowalski came out of the bathroom, a towel wrapped around his waist. "They got jets that hit you in all the right places, and a few wrong ones."
It seemed the dreams of some men weren't as lofty as others. Gray turned his back on the cityscape. With his shoulders still blistered and sore, a shower held no appeal at the moment. Maybe a long bath. The group shared a 2-bedroom suite. Kowalski and Gray had one room, Seishan the other. Tucker and Kane staked out the couch in the common room, equipped with a pool table, a wet bar, and a flat-screen television. Gray heard a BBC broadcast playing out there.
"I'm gonna see if Tucker wants to lose a few bucks playing pool," Kowalski said, and headed toward the door, hauling on a robe and letting his wet towel fall to the floor. Gray stepped toward the bathroom. There wasn't much else they could do except to continue waiting for an intelligence report from Sigma Command.
Painter was gathering data on flights into and out of Somalia, comparing all routes that could bring Amanda and her kidnappers to Dubai. He was also checking passenger manifests, searching custom records, specifically looking for faces that matched Amanda's, in case someone tried to sneak her through with a fake passport. He also had a team scouring security footage from Dubai International Airport. Gray didn't hold out much hope. His team had already spent an hour at the airport, tracking all the exits and baggage areas, checking to see if Kane could pick up her scent. Nothing. Maybe she never came here. Or came and left. But Gray didn't think so, and couldn't exactly say why. It was more than a gut feeling, like something that beckoned at the edge of his awareness, something he was missing. In the bathroom, he turned on the tub's tap, tested the water, and once satisfied, he slowly peeled off his shirt. Pieces stuck to his shoulders, pasted in place by his blistered skin. With a groan, he tugged the shirt off, stripped out of the rest of his clothes, and climbed into the tub. It was wonderful agony to sink into the steaming heat. He left the tap running, letting the waterline climb up his belly. He leaned forward, hugging his knees, carefully stretching the stiffened skin across his shoulders. "Dear God, Gray, your back looks horrible." He twisted half around to face the open door. Seishan stood there, her gaze not shying from his nakedness. He was too tired to be self-conscious. They'd both seen each other at their best and worst. What was a little bare skin? He turned off the flowing tap. "I'm fine." "What is it?" "You're not fine. Why didn't you tell someone your burn was this bad?" "I'm getting the med pack. Here." She stepped forward and passed him the satellite phone. "Call from Sigma." He took the phone. "Director?" "Gray, I just wanted to give you an update while I have a spare moment." He sat higher in the tub. "Any leads?" "No, I'm afraid not. We've searched every record and videotape from Dubai International. I can find no evidence that Amanda ever passed through there. I'll keep monitoring the airport and inbound manifests, but I've also expanded the search for flights out of the city. We have to take into account that she may have already been moved. If that's the case, we're not likely to ever find her. At least not alive." "I'll keep looking," Painter said. "But for now, we'll keep your team on site. Even if she has shipped out, it might not have been far, and I want you and the others close by." "Understood." Gray signed off as Seishan returned. She took the phone, set it aside, then tapped the edge of the tub. "Up here. Back to me." She opened the combat med kit and pulled out a tube of burn cream and water gel tactical dressing. "I don't need you to—" "I could get Kowalski to do it. But I don't think either of you would like that." He sighed heavily, pulled out of the bathwater, and balanced on the lip of the tub. She patted his skin dry with great care. From the corner of his eye, he caught her reflection in the mirror. She rubbed the cream between her palms and placed them against his heated skin. The balm's cooling agent sank deep into his flesh, outlining each of her fingers. A small moan escaped him. "Am I hurting you?" "No," he said, more huskily than he intended. Her hand spread outward, washing away the worst of his pain. He stretched his back, loosening his shoulders even further. His breathing grew heavier, deeper as she worked. His eyelids drifted closed. She remained silent. He heard only her breath, sighing in and out. Fingers rode up his neckline and down his spine. He found himself leaning back into her touch, and not just because of the cooling effect of the balm. In fact, warmth was returning to his skin, but not from the burn. It rose from a fire deeper inside. His body responded, but he didn't bother to hide it, Not that he could.
Gray.
He heard the need in her voice that matched his own. He reached back and caught one of her hands. He held it, poised between pulling her closer or pushing her away, trapped between heaven and hell. Her fingers, soft and silky, trembled in his palm like a bird fluttering to escape. Not this time. His hand tightened on hers, making a decision at last. He chose heaven. As he drew her arm around him, twisting to face her, their lips brushing against one another, then he suddenly knew the truth. He froze with shock. Gray? What is it? He tilted back, his eyes widening as his certainty grew.
I know where Amanda is.
11:32 p.m.
You should keep walking, Dr. Blake said, supporting her by the elbow. It can help the baby get into a better position.
Amanda shambled down a featureless white hallway. She had no idea where she was, nor the time of day. She'd woken in a windowless hospital room 4 hours ago. The medical team had performed another ultrasound on her, along with a pelvic exam, removing a sponge-like object from inside her. Dr. Blake had explained. We inserted a synthetic osmotic dilator while you were sedated to gently help open your cervix. It's an old-school technique, but still effective in preparation for labor. It was only then she had learned they were inducing her, forcing her to deliver her baby early. She protested, but the protests fell on deaf ears. All she got for her trouble was a patronizing reassurance that she was well enough along, and that there would be little risk to the baby or herself. That failed to relieve her. She remembered what she'd overheard during the flight, the plans for her child to be dissected like some lab animal. She had to find a way to stop them. As she walked, she supported her belly with one hand, as if trying to hold her baby where it was safe, willing her body not to surrender. But 10 minutes ago, a prostaglandin gel had been applied vaginally, the first steps toward inducing labor.
I won't let them have my baby.
Ahead, she saw a wide window on one side of the hallway, bright with light. She hurried forward, breaking free of Blake's grip.
Maybe there's a way out, or some sign of where I am.
And deeper down lurked darker thoughts of throwing herself out a high window, of plummeting to her death rather than letting them torture her baby boy. She reached the window and fell back in horror. The light didn't come from the sun, but from the stark halogens of a biological clean lab. She flashed back to a similar facility in Charleston, where her in vitro fertilization had been performed. Like back home, this lab had multiple workstations and microscopes. It was all polished stainless steel or non-porous surfaces. But what made her weak in the knees was the research project facing her. Literally. A disembodied human head hung before her, bolted to a stanchion above a rack as tall as a man. A foot below that horror, a nest of plastic tubing suspended a human heart. A pacemaker-like device had been wired into the dark muscle and sat atop the tissue like a silver spider. The heart contracted every couple of seconds, jumping slightly in its webbing, and below that, a set of pink lungs hung in a glass vat, the disembodied tissue bellowing in and out, hooked to a ventilator. Other body parts loomed in murkier jars farther down, but she shied away from them,